It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Hey, never touch the buttons. I can use some information.
Whoa, for this price, I'll tell you whatever you want.
I'm looking for a hut.
Close for the night. Thank you.
Gangsters, war criminals.
Long live the Empire.
We'll take out every bad guy in your deck of cards.
This isn't about revenge. It's about preventing another war.
Strap in.
You will suffer. And then it will be his turn.
Before going into harm's way, check your armor.
The kid will live centuries beyond me. I won't always be around to protect him.
Are you scared? You should be.
Do we run? Or do we fight?
I like this kid.
What are you waiting for? Save the rest for after dinner.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and as always, next to me in the internet is Mr. Sean Whalen.
Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to be here with you. And you people don't know what kind of machinations we have to go through to manage to find a time to get this guest on the show. But last week I saw The Mandalorian and Grogu, and I said, oh, we should do a show on that. So I reached out to the biggest Star Wars fans I know, and a couple of them couldn't make it, but probably the biggest Star Wars fan I know, Mr. Scott Rifen, managed to work us into his schedule. So welcome aboard, Scott. Ooh. Thank you for coming on.
I am so glad. I love being invited on the program, and then I love trying to figure out how we can be on the program. So it's great. It's great.
Yeah, for those of you who are not familiar with Scott, he does a radio program in Georgia, and he is on at 6 a.m., which I believe, I suspect at least, means probably getting up in the morning about 3:30 or so on a regular basis.
Three, okay.
Yeah. And that makes scheduling a good time to record kind of difficult sometimes. But we, you know.
Yeah, between that and I do a couple of trivia nights a week. And so then your afternoons and evenings are messed up. And then during the fall, it's high school football in addition to all that. And yeah, it gets messy.
And then you have one of those things, what are they called? Oh, a wife. You know, that,
yeah,
that,
yes,
that requires, yes, some of your time also.
Yes. And I'm a big fan of staying married. That's a big one for me.
Yeah. So I'm sure, I because of that, I give great credit to the fact that you make the time to come on with us every once in a while. So thank you.
I love being invited. Thank you.
So The Mandalorian and Grogu. I have this thing where, well, first of all, just I generally nowadays, I have a 98-inch TV set in what we call our movie room. So I don't go to the theater unless it's something special for me that I really feel like it's worth going to the theater. So I'm usually looking for either something that's going to be totally engrossing or spectacle. Now, mm-hmm, on top of that, add that to the fact that if you have a show that's on TV and they're doing a movie version of the show, I need for it to say to me, I'm giving you something that you can't get on TV at home. And I have some kind of mixed feelings, and I guess we'll talk more in depth as we go on, because I feel like I got the spectacle. I think the action scenes in this are really good and spectacular. There's some real good special effects in here. But I don't really feel like I got the engrossing, world-changing story. I feel like we started with a status quo. We ended with that same status quo. I didn't think there was really any, yeah, kind of character movement in it. So that's my thumbnail sketch of my review on it. What do you guys think? Either.
So for me, I saw it on Friday, and Star Wars movies, I've seen all of them on the big screen. So I wanted to see this on the big screen just because of that aspect of it. I love the show. So I want to be very clear on that. One of the things that I love about the show is Star Wars, and it's the difference between Star Wars and Star Trek for me. There needs to be a little dirt under the fingernails if I'm making any sense. It's got to be that kind of gritty thing. And one of the things I think the show succeeded at was keeping that grit. That feeling like it's not overly polished, not overly clean. There's wear and tear on the ships. There's dust, dirt, and grime. You feel like if you're going to play in Star Wars world, you're going to get dirty. You're going through swamps. You're climbing through all kinds of areas like that. It accomplished atmospherically all of that. I took my wife, who has not seen all the seasons of the show, which was really, and it wasn't deliberately for this, I just said, do you want to go? And she wanted to see it. The nice part about her seeing it is she doesn't have the background. So it was cool to go with her and see, did you need to know anything in order to go into this? And I, like, in the first few minutes of the film, she was asking some quick questions about things. But then afterwards, as the film got going, that stopped. So as far as a contained piece, it was accessible. Which was an interesting sort of thing, because I was really afraid that, like, I was going to be throughout the film having to fill her in on a lot of backstory. So it did, as far as the story goes, it had a good,
strong beginning, middle, ending. I kind of have to when I go to the movies with my wife.
Anyway. Yes, I do too. And this was one where I wanted to go in, kind of the point of where you're going there. I really wanted to just relax and enjoy it. And I did it in first, like, 10 minutes. Okay, I had to do the exposition pieces, and then we were done, and just enjoying the film. Paul, some of your criticisms I agree with, as far as this didn't feel like this wasn't that story that, like, earth-shatteringly changed the Star Wars universe. The best way I can equate this, and I've used this on the show before, this was a good popcorn flick. There was a lot of action. There was a lot of adventure. I enjoyed the story a great deal. It wasn't a needle mover in the sense that I'm going, wow, this was universe changing or anything like that. I like these characters quite a bit, so I had a lot of fun with it. It is, kind of to your point, a bigger version of the TV episode. So the only thing I would say, could they, I wouldn't even argue that they can't do that on TV nowadays. You can, because now due to streaming, you're not stuck to your typical block. So they could have done this as an extended TV episode, and I think it would have worked. I'd be interested to look at the budget of this versus the budget of a normal episode of the show. And I'm wondering if maybe we got something more there because of it, something that they couldn't have done on TV because they released it theatrically. It sounds like I didn't enjoy it. I did. I really enjoyed it. And I mean, we'll talk more about like where I actually rate this one as we kind of go on through, but I found it to be a very enjoyable ride. It, I enjoy seeing even TV shows when they do them in the big screen. There's something about when certain programs, I don't need to see everything on the big screen, but sometimes they'll do those special releases where it's a kickoff of a show or a special episode that they're going to do. And I do enjoy seeing them in the theater. I feel like that environment lends itself to the community, lends itself to the better sound system. I've got a big screen TV in the basement and a sound system too, but there's still, I am not going to pretend that I'm replicating the theater experience in my home. And that part for Star Wars, the music, the sound effects, the, you know, all of that, I really like seeing there. But this, did this feel to me like an expanded television episode? Yes. That part I'll say was definitely a thing with this one versus feeling like Rogue One, for example. Probably Rogue One felt like a movie, like in the theater, that kind of spectacle. So if I'm comparing the two, really enjoyable, glad I went to see it, but much more of an expansion of the TV, a contained expansion of the TV show versus being like a Rogue One where I was. The Darth Vader sequence in Rogue One, you know, I won't go too crazy, spoiler on that one, but is one of those things that still, I'm still in awe of it today. This did not have that, but I really enjoyed it.
Now, Scott, I know you saw it at least twice. What'd you think?
Yeah, I've seen it twice. Yeah. I liked it better the second time because the first time I fell asleep during the first half hour. And, I find that when you watch the whole thing, it is a better film. I don't know why that is. That was, by the way, not the case with The Last Jedi, which I fell asleep during one of my viewings of Last Jedi, and it got better when I fell asleep during it. So,
well, I do. You know, we mentioned your work schedule, and I think that might lend itself to occasionally falling asleep in an odd.
You know,
place.
I did the same thing with. I did the same thing with Dial of Destiny when I went and saw it and I dozed off for a few minutes here and there. And then I came out just really angry. I was like, this is the worst thing I've ever seen. I watched it a second. I went, well, it's not that bad. It's not great, but it's not that bad. This reminds me of, you remember when they did the Cheers movie back in the 80s and they did the big theatrical release around Cheers and, or no, maybe you don't remember. No, they didn't do that. But it did kind of strike me as... No, it did strike me as kind of a sitcom type situation where, as Sean mentioned, actually, it's the same movie at the characters exactly the same at the end as they are at the beginning. They didn't learn anything. They didn't grow any. They just went through an adventure, which is nice. But at the same time, it is hard to stand up and tell people, hey, you need to come in here and spend $15 to come see this thing where nothing, you know, ultimately nothing happens. You know, there's a lot that I liked about it. There's a lot I didn't like about it. The opening 10 minutes is some of the best 10 minutes you're going to see anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, just, you know, you got walkers in the snow.
Adventure and yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. You got snow troopers. You got all that stuff. But it's kind of a reverse Raiders where, you know, Raiders opens up with some of the best 10 minutes you'll ever see. And then it just gets better after that. And this movie, kind of that first 10 minutes is kind of the best you're going to see of this movie. It's what's interesting to me is, you know, I think we all kind of agree it feels like it's a big episode of the TV show or maybe several big episodes of the TV show. And everything I've read, like Favreau says they had season 4 mapped out and maybe some of it written, but then when they decided to do a film, they kind of threw all that out and started from scratch and wrote a movie, and it wasn't based on a season. But when you watch it, the structure of it feels like it's a bunch of episodes of a TV show.
Yes.
It kind of feels like you're doing something, you're going on a mission, there's rising action, then you accomplish it, and there's falling action. And then you start over again, and you rise, and you build up to a thing that you're doing, and then you fall again. I feel like that kind of hurts it. In that the pacing just doesn't flow well. And there's about 10 minutes right before the start of the third act. I don't know how spoiler heavy we get into this stuff, but there's about 10 minutes right before the start.
As long as you give us a warning, if you say we're going spoilers, okay. Which now we're giving that warning to anybody listening, there will be spoilers. Scott, feel free.
Okay. there's about 10 minutes before the start of the third act where the movie just grinds to a halt.
Yes.
And it just sits there. And you know, watching it the second time, I kind of started deconstructing some of the stuff. And I said, you know, if this 10 minutes were the opening 10 minutes of an episode, you know, there's a cliffhanger and they open with this 10 minutes, we would all be fine with this. But for it to come so late in the film, you know, where the momentum should really just be carrying you. It just, like, it's almost inexcusable that it's paced the way it's paced. Again, had it been broken into episodes, I think it probably would have played better. But yeah, it's a little frustrating when you see, you know, like Transformers, the movie. Let's go back to the 80s for that one. They kill Optimus Prime. Spoiler alert, 40 years later. They kill Optimus Prime. You know, if they make major changes, even though it's a stupid cartoon that's made in Korea, they did something that was major with the characters and that made a difference and affected everything going forward. I feel like if you're going to do a feature film, you should have something like that as part of the film. Some major, and I'm not saying you got to kill somebody, but you should have some major development. You should have some major thing happen that does kind of change the status quo a little, raises the stakes a little. And I don't know that we had that. Was it pleasant? Was it a good diversion? Yes. It was competently made. It was well put together. There were a lot of things that were neat. There were a lot of great Easter eggs when they're in the arena and they have a Dejeric mode. I thought that was really neat.
Yes.
You know, because you got to see all the guys from the Dejeric board from the first film coming out. But the reality, I think, with this is you've seen kind of the way Lucasfilm has announced a lot of movies that have just not gotten made. You've seen Lucasfilm announce projects that just disappear. And turned out, and I started keeping track of the numbers, and it was like Marvel had put out like $20 billion in box office gross, and Lucasfilm had done about $300 million in box office gross over the same time period. And, you know, the reality was Lucasfilm wasn't generating box office revenue. And at one point, streaming was everything. Streaming was the Cadillac, and they all wanted streaming, and they wanted to build up stream. But the truth was streaming isn't, you know, it generates a certain amount of revenue, but it's not worth spending all the money and dumping all that programming on there. So there starts to be some pressure from your parent company to generate some box office revenue. And I think Lucasfilm, I think this movie came about, I really do. I believe this movie came about because they said, we've got to make some revenue. You know, we got to generate some box office revenue while at the same time, we can't seem to get a movie made. But we have a crew, we have a creative, you know, core with Mandalorian, we could make a movie and get it into theaters and generate some revenue. And I really think that's why this movie exists. You know, not so much we had a special story we wanted to tell that was bigger than TV, but more, we've got to generate some box office revenue. Let's get it out there.
I also think there's another reason why they did it safe. They've had problems with some of their Star Wars movies and quite frankly, some of the television too, where it has been divisive.
Yeah.
And at least on paper, Mandalorian and Grogu is safe. You know, you've got a larger mass appeal to it. It's interesting with how this is doing box office wise, because number wise, it's okay. But it's not. But it's not certainly generating the numbers that the popularity of this show when it was at its peak should have been generating. This should have been pulling people into the theater. And I think that's what they were going for. This is safe. Grogu's cute. It became a pop culture hit. And all of that part was working. I think you nailed something. And I did not hit this until you brought it up. This movie does feel like it ends more than once.
Mm-hmm.
And it does start up again. I think there's a certain sequence where Mando's in some serious danger. Might not have been a bad cliffhanger for the end of this film, knowing that this universe, because this universe is supposed to continue and supposed to eventually get wrapped up, might not have been a bad place for us to leave him in peril, you know, and thinking maybe he died, you know, as far as that end goes.
I actually like that, yeah.
But what I say that, and I liked the next episode.
that's the thing.
We got to see the interactions between the two of them and Grogu. You know, it was telegraphed what was going to happen with Grogu.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed where that went. But I was not thinking episodic structure until you brought that up. And I'm honestly seeing where, like, I'm like, yeah, this felt like it ended multiple times. And I don't know that I needed it to continue. Like, I was done watching those couple episodes, and I don't know that I needed another episode then.
And I think where you're talking about when you say Mando's in trouble, and again, we're tiptoeing around spoilers here. That's exactly where I'm talking about. Where it just stops for a second, for 10 minutes.
Well, the interesting thing is on that is I have an app on my phone that tells that if
the pee break?
Yes. and it told me right then, because there's this, again, spoilers. Grogu is trying to put Mando into the log to preserve him, I guess. And it says, after you hear the third time that Mando's head hits the log, you have time for a break. so at that point, I got up
that's
and I
correct. Walked
away for 2 minutes to use the Mando.
Well, and that, again, that's the spot that we're talking about where it just kind of stops. But what happens from that, and I think Sean also made the same point, which is if that moment were the beginning of something and you weren't three quarters of the way through or two thirds of the way through something, if that were the beginnings, that would be interesting. And it would be kind of a hook and you would be intrigued and you would be watching it and you would not question at all the pacing of that because it would be the start of something and you're building towards something. But at that point in the film, we've already built. And now you're asking us to stop. And then eventually we'll get started again. And again, what comes after it, it would play like a really good episode or like the start of a good part two. I think a lot of times these guys are missing the boat with inviting people back. You know, I mentioned Last Jedi earlier. One of my big complaints about Last Jedi is it ends. It's the middle movie in a trilogy and it just ends. You know, it's they wrap everything up that they need to wrap up. There's no invitation to come back. When you watch Infinity War, at the end of Infinity War, holy cow, half of everybody's gone. Spider-Man turned into dust. You know, what's going to happen next? You're invited back because you're left with a lot of questions when you walk out. You can do that in a movie like Mando and Grogu and say, hey, is Mando dead? You know, you can get the Batman announcer to come in. What's this? Is Mando done for good? Grogu on his own? You know, come back next year, same theaters, you know, then. They didn't, but yeah, Sean's right. It could have been, that would have been a really good breaking point to invite people back for another one and to get people buzzing, get people talking. And that's a thing that's not really happened.
Sorry to interrupt. We've had a lot of talk over time about anticipation when you go into a movie. And frankly, going in, my impression was basically the same as Sean's, that the people in the world of Disney said, this is a safe property. We know it's popular. We haven't had a Star Wars movie since Solo, which was underrated by, as far as I believe we are concerned. I don't mean to speak for you guys, but and it underperformed. So let's come up with something safe to do. Now, my anticipation, if you said, if you got me to say, what do I think is going to happen in this movie? I did expect some character growth. I expected somehow that the writers were going to put them in a scene of great peril where you're saying, how the hell is Mando getting out of this? And all of a sudden, Grogu was going to step up and use the Force in a spectacular way to save the day for everybody, and that his character was now going to grow in that he's showing his level of power, and maybe it's just kind of a thing where it rose and it's gonna dim again. He doesn't have to be this all powerful Phoenix character as it's going on, but something where he really was the hero of the show when it ended, and give you some sort of a really satisfactory resolution. And I think they've built up the character of Grogu to the point where you wouldn't feel it was a deus ex machina. I think you'd feel like, okay, now the character is showing what his potential is. I think that would have been a satisfactory way to end it, and they didn't give us that. They gave him, okay, he used his mind, you know, his force powers to heal the wound on Mando. Okay, but that really doesn't do it for me.
He's done that before.
Yeah, that you well, know, he's done that before. And that was one of the disappointments I had, is I wanted something. Mm-hmm. I think if you had given me that ending, I would have walked out of there with a much, much higher opinion. And my opinion wasn't bad. I was entertained by this movie. And I want to make that clear. I am a great detractor of people who feel that, you know, in this internet age where something either has to be the best or the worst. This was okay. This was enjoyable. It wasn't the best. It wasn't the worst. Mm-hmm. It was a fun movie to go and see. But I think it could have been more.
Mm-hmm.
I think the mistake that it made here is, and I, one of the strengths of this was with Zeb being in there, and the fact that they were bringing in the continuing the animation, the links to Ahsoka, you know, all those kinds of things that they're doing with it. I like that. Actually, I love what they're doing with this. I love this world building that they've done. Where I think it wasn't successful, this film should be that thing that gets you excited for what comes next. I should be excited for either Ahsoka season 2 or for how that season is going to converge with this. Because this is supposed to all wrap up. There's supposed to be, my understanding, I think there's another movie that's going to be coming, that's going to wrap that whole universe off. Again, this is the internet, like, rumors that are out there. Yeah. So take everything I just said with a grain of salt. But I'm hoping what I would want as a fan, because of the fact that I've invested a lot of time into this shared world that they've crafted, I think overall it's been really good. I was hoping this was going to get me pumped up. I found it to be a very enjoyable movie. I was glad I went to go see it. It's multiple beginning, middle, and endings. I enjoyed. I'm glad that I saw it. I felt like I was binge watching. And sometimes when you binge watch, you know how I've watched 2 episodes and I'm kind of done binge watching for now. Mm-hmm. I think that's what happened with me with this, where I ended up watching the 3rd episode. I enjoyed it, but I was kind of done for a while. And yeah. I felt like this needed that feeling where leave me. And I think, Paul, you said anticipation before. Leave me with that anticipation of what comes next. It sounds like I'm trashing this. I really am not. I had a good time. And I think we got to get into that, you know, as far as what the pieces were, where there was a good time to be had here. Cause I would recommend seeing this to somebody listening to this, but you go in with the reality of this is not going to be that earth shattering Star Wars movie where you're like, I've never been a Star Wars fan before. Now I'm a convert. This is not that movie. This is not where I would start somebody.
No.
But it was. It is definitely, if you're a Star Wars fan, this is an enjoyable movie that's safe, that you can take that fan who did not like some of the stuff along the way, because we've got different categories of Star Wars fans. I'll admit I'm the geek that's, to varying degrees, I've enjoyed all of it. But there's people in different places out there when it comes to the Star Wars films. This is a safe film to take anybody that you know that has remotely enjoyed Star Wars to. And I think they're going to have a good time with this one.
I think one of the big problems with Star Wars fans, and I'm trying to justify them here instead of trashing them. But I think the problem... That's right.
Good luck.
I think the problem is the original trilogy has captured our imagination since we were young, varying degrees of young as I'm older than you guys. But, you know, I was still in my teens when the first one came out. And I think we all were just, you know, really captured by it and the 2 sequels. And since then, anything that doesn't reach that level is a disappointment. And I think that's the thing. I think it's almost like we're Star Wars drug addicts and we're looking to recapture that first high, and we can't do that. And this movie is not going to do that for you. But if you can distance yourself from that initial feeling and just say, I just want an entertaining experience, I honestly haven't seen anything Star Wars, and I saw the Clone Wars cartoon movie in the theater. But I haven't seen anything, if I distance myself from that, that isn't somewhat entertaining at some point, including that. But you have to distance yourself. If you go to see that Clone Wars cartoon and you're expecting it to be something that's going to compete with the original trilogy, you're gonna walk out of there, you know, and go on suicide watch.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the one thing I could say, and I thought it during the movie, was, oh, no, they're going to show us Zero the Hutt again. And I don't want to see that.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of the Clone Wars movie.
Yes, I thought we were going to go there. I thought we were going to just get a CGI version of him. And I was thinking, I'm going to hate this when it's done because of that. Because that character I found bothersome. Let's leave it at that. And
you don't like Truman Capote as a Hutt?
No, I do not. I actually found, now all of a sudden I'm drawing a blank on the name of the young Hutt that they are.
Rata.
In theory, rescuing. I'm sorry? What was it?
Rata.
I found his character, yeah. Rata. I found his character to be entertaining, actually. I found him to be one of the more engrossing aspects of this movie, that he was rejecting that lifestyle and that he was the one who gave us a little character growth or a little story arc that, you know, we didn't get from the other characters. So I found his inclusion in the film to be somewhat entertaining.
I've had several people say to me, well, you know, Rata has character growth, but he doesn't really. I mean, because he enters the movie the same way he leaves the movie, which is not wanting to be part of his father's legacy. I mean, I do agree with that he's an interesting character. And you know what's really nice is it used to drive me nuts that in the 90s in particular, when they first started the expanded universe, everybody from a certain planet was exactly the same guy. So, like, all Rodians were bounty hunters. You know, all, like, everybody of a species from a planet. You go, well, how did civilization arise when they don't have scientists, they only have bounty hunters? I'm not sure how that happens. But, you know, and all Hutts are gangsters. And so it was nice to see Rata not be all Hutts are gangsters. That was nice.
I think one of the areas where what's interesting about Rata is, I think if you've watched the show and you've seen season one of the show, Mando handles Rata different now than he would have handled him in season one. The problem with that is when we're talking about growth in this film, that's based on season one, not based on this film. But right. I loved Rata. I thought it was a great character. I liked the buff, you know, like the combat. I thought that sequence was a lot of fun. I think it was a very good use of, they built him up to be, you know, really badass at the point in time that they were using him. And then when we got the later fight where they were surrounded and with overwhelming numbers, I thought that was really cool because you've already established now that he is that kind of player in all of this. But I love that the numbers were overwhelming both of them. And if you're going to have somebody with Mando's skills and you're going to have somebody with his skills, you got to give us that epic sequence where you're like, you feel the sense of danger. That part they did succeed in. Mm-hmm. There was multiple points in time in this where I felt genuine danger. They suspended my disbelief. That's where the entertainment value came in. I did think combat, battle, that this is what more of what I wanted from things like Book of Boba Fett. Because, you know, Empire Strikes Back, going back to that, one of the coolest things leading up to it was Boba Fett. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Mandalorian's been like my dream of what I would have wanted from Boba Fett all along. So that part, there's some combat sequences with him where we see his expert skills that against overwhelming numbers, where it isn't he's perfect, it's ugly. There's, you know, there's points in time where he has to get creative. He's picking up weapons, you know, that are discarded. He's got to grab things from under the water. I loved all of that because, again, the fighting was dirty. It was gritty. It wasn't overly clean. And that's something I thought they succeeded in, was keeping that grit part of it. Mm-hmm. It's what I liked about the original trilogy, going back to what Paul said about that. And I think when Star Wars gets a little too clean, it loses some of that charm of the improvisation, that kind of feeling over it. And this, I thought, captured that really well. I enjoyed the combat sequences quite a bit. They felt episodic, like we've said. I don't want to be a broken record on that, but I enjoyed those sequences quite a bit.
Yeah, let's also give credit to Brendan Wayne. It was nice to see him get a credit on the opening of the film, you know, when they did the opening credits.
Agreed.
Brendan Wayne, he really is the Mandalorian most of the time. You know, he's the guy in the suit the bulk of the time. And so the physical acting that is that character is Brendan Wayne. So when you see him, you know, the looks, the movements, the, you know, and there's a second guy who's the stunt Mandalorian, but Brendan Wayne, really John Wayne's grandson, really does contribute a significant amount to that character and who he is and how he looks and how he moves and how he, you know, how he responds to things and kind of how we think of him. It's a lot more than Pedro Pascal, you know, who's in, I think, basically one scene in the film. If we add it up, he basically did a couple of days of shooting and a couple of days of looping and he was done. But Brendan Wayne is the guy who kind of pulls the dramatic weight for everything else. And he does it. He has to do it wordlessly.
Yeah.
You know, he has to emote through a mask and armor. And I just think he does a really good job of that. And I think that's, you know, a lot of what I think you enjoyed about the action sequences and that kind of thing, Sean, I think a lot of it is kind of at his feet.
Agreed.
I have what I am terming Pedro Pascal fatigue. He just seems to be in every geek thing going nowadays. Mm-hmm. And it was one of my criticisms when we reviewed the most recent Fantastic Four movie was I definitely would have cast someone else as Mr. Fantastic. But I think that because of the nature of this story and because we had literally just a couple of minutes in one scene of Pedro Pascal, other than his voice, it managed to help me avoid some of that fatigue. It was less bothersome. If he had taken off the helmet early on and you know, if it was, we could liken it to, you know, one of the Marvel movies with Tony Stark, where he has the Iron Man helmet off through, you know, three quarters of the movie because you need to see Robert Downey Jr.'s face. If we had that in this movie, I think it would have been a lesser film because of it. Plus, there's the mystique of the Mandalorian. And that was one of the badass moments in it, too, is when the helmet's off and they say, well, now we've, you know, we've dishonored you. It's not if anybody who's seen me without the mask lives or doesn't live, whatever.
Yeah. However dies. Yeah.
I thought that was his badass moment in the movie because they're captive at that point and he's saying it. So, you know, I thought that was one of the highlights to me. So.
I think you're hitting on something there with him because I like him quite a bit, actually. But I do think his overexposure in the geek films is hurting him because of the fact that I relate it to him being him. My favorite movies are the ones where no matter who or how popular the actor is, at a certain point in time, I start believing they're that character. When the helmet came off, it was immediately Pedro Pascal. It was not the Mandalorian. And there's something to that for me that takes me out of it, which is unusual. And I do think I love the show. I love The Mandalorian. But when that came off, I'm like, it was so clear we were doing it. So we've got Pedro on screen. And I'm like, I love the mystique of like now everybody's got to die because of the fact that they've seen him. I actually dig all of that. The problem is that sequence did take me out of it a bit because it was now the guy from The Last of Us who is there instead of I need to be in the zone right now. This is the Mandalorian. This is the world that I've been transported to. And that is a distinction with this that I don't say about other films. Usually the acting talent keeps me in the zone. I know it's the actor, yes, but they've so Harrison Ford as Han Solo, right? You can watch the other movies over and over again. I've seen him as Indiana Jones. I've seen him in so many great films along the way. I get transported to the fact that he's Han Solo during that time. When he's Indiana Jones, I get transported to the fact that he's Indiana Jones. you know, shrinking, you know, totally getting his character there. That it's that's where you need to be transported by an actor. I think his overexposure, to your point, Paul, is where when that helmet came off, it was Pedro. And that hit me on that. It did take me out of it a bit.
I totally agree with you. And the way I can reconcile it in my mind is the first role that he had where I specifically took note of him was when he was on Game of Thrones. Mm. And I loved him on Game of Thrones because I was not overexposed to him. I thought he was great on that, and I thought his character was great. So I think it really is the overexposure, but there's also some choice of roles too, because like in Wonder Woman 1984, I hated that movie, and it didn't matter who played his part.
No.
So
the funny thing about Wonder Woman 1984 is when he saw it, he started complaining to me. He's like, why did they hire a Hispanic guy to play Maxwell Lord? I don't understand that. I said, no, that was a choice. The accent was a choice. He's no, it wasn't. That guy's no, that's Pedro Pascal. He's the Mandalorian. That was a choice. Trust me. It's just a bad movie. But the funny thing about Mandalorian is it's kind of most superhero movies frustrate me because at some point it's mandatory that we have to take the mask off for a considerable amount of time because the actors want their face time. For Mandalorian, it's rare that you get face time with the actor, and I'm okay with that. And if they had gone that whole movie with no face time for the actor, it would have been just fine. But I'm sure there was a moment where he's got to be in the movie. We've got to have him in the film.
But they turned it into a badass moment.
And they did. But I appreciate Mandalorian because they don't go out of their way a lot to take him out of the mask. I mean, they do some, but they actually kind of wrote it into the conceit of the show. Sorry, you can't take the helmet off. What are we going to do?
Agreed.
And, I actually appreciate that because so many super. I mean, how often does Spider-Man have to get his mask ripped off or torn to shreds or whatever? Because we've got to see the actor's face emoting. And it's like, no. In 2008, they learned a very important lesson, which was when you make a comic book movie, you can actually make it like the comic book and people will like it. And it was, they finally figured that out really big time with Iron Man to me. I mean, it was a little bit of Batman, but to me, not as much. And for some reason, the one thing they haven't learned is, and it may just be the actors and their ego, and it may be their contracts, and they mandate a lot of FaceTime. But in the comics, they don't get their masks ripped off every 5 seconds. And I kind of appreciate that.
I think it's the studio saying, we paid this much money for...
We paid good money for this guy.
Fill in the actor's name there. We're going to show his face.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it from a logic point of view, and again, I'll just go to, you know, Robert Downey Jr. as Tony Stark. There's scenes where he's in the middle of combat and he drops the mask. Why would you expose yourself to potential danger when you have a helmet on that's going to protect you? There's no logical
reason. It's technically a bad idea.
I need to show my face.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's the studio. I don't even think it's the actors' egos because
that's a fair point.
I think Pedro Pascal was said to, you know, I think he signed his contract for this movie and he was probably giggling all the way saying, I only have to be there for, you know, 1 week and I get the starring credit for the movie. Mm-hmm. One of the things I do like about how they execute this is because of the way his character is, his line delivery is very monotone and very just unemotional. And that eliminates some of the Pascal fatigue for me because it doesn't feel so much like him. It feels like, you know, it feels more like the character because of the delivery.
And it works. I actually really do like the delivery because it makes him feel very disciplined and very trained, which is really important for the character. Because there's a fine line with that where you could make it boring. You know, where like sometimes you got characters that are monotone and they almost put you to sleep. It doesn't happen with the Mandalorian. They've found that sweet spot of how to have it and actually make him feel like he's polished. Actually, when he does show emotion, it means more because of the way that they have the character do that. Like the part where Grogu comes back and saves him, I actually really enjoyed all of that. That one was, you could see that coming from a mile away, but sometimes it's okay to do that. And that was a great example of where, you know, he's sticking around. He's not leaving with them, and he's going to show up on the scene and somehow be a factor in this. And I was good with every little bit of that, because I thought Grogu is, and again, it goes back to the development we've seen of Grogu in the show. It's great when you see Grogu actually accomplishing things. And, you know, I mean, we've got force powers there. We've got, it's a fun character, but it's not, it can't always be about the comedy, which is, I think, something that's a danger with a character like that. And I think the same thing with the Anzellans, I think, is the little creatures who do the repair.
Anzellans,
I think they had to be functional. All of them have to be functional at some point in time. If it's just about the comedy, what ends up happening then is now the movie loses any kind of excitement. I want to see them do something where you're like, oh yeah, they're like worth it. Like, why is it cool that he's on his back? Because every so often he's going to do some cool things that actually help out during the fight and make it like interesting. And I actually quite like that.
I'm thinking
one of the things,
as you're saying this, I'm just trying to figure out an example. And what I'm coming up with, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it's been a while since I sat and watched the movie, but I'm thinking the failure of that, or an example of the failure of that, would be in The Last Jedi when they had the, what are they called? Porgs. They're just there to be cute. There's no purpose to them whatsoever other than, hey, look at them, they're cute. None. And they do kind of fail for that reason.
But the Anzellans serve a function, and honestly, I would watch an Anzellans movie tomorrow.
I would too.
I love those guys.
That would remind me of the Minions from Despicable Me if they did that.
Well, if you want to swap out the Minions for the Anzellans, I'm very fine with that. I would replace every Minion with an Anzellan in a heartbeat.
Well, I don't say that necessarily as a negative. I'm saying it. That's what I would expect to get from them, though.
Yeah. I think Sean's going in some of these directions. We'll see if you guys both will go there. At that late stage in the film, when Mando has been poisoned and he's out cold, and Grogu's trying to help him, and the first thing he does is he builds a little hut. If you remember. Builds it out of mud and the materials in the forest. And the hut looks staggeringly like Yoda's hut in Empire Strikes Back. And I'm wondering if this is, different species have certain things that they're kind of instinctively programmed to do. Do you think that's what that was supposed to be? Was kind of a sign that he is following his genetic programming to do this thing?
I had not considered that. I hadn't thought of that at all until you just said it, but it definitely sounds it sounds right. It's either the writers had come up with that and I give them credit for it, or it's a happy accident. And either way, I think it works way.
There's certainly no point in the past where he's taught how to do this that we've seen on screen. So you have to go, well, is this something that's instinctive amongst his species?
What I love the comedy bit of it was to scale. It wasn't big enough for Mando.
Yeah.
Which goes back to get your point of I'm used to crafting things for me. Because you run into that too at the Anzellan ship, where they arrive back at the ship and they're all going to escape and they show up there and there's this tiny ship that everyone can fit in, but Mando.
Yeah.
Which was, I think some of that stuff really worked well. Because of it, and I felt like all of that, yes, they were chuckle moments, but they were also made sense. They weren't just there for comedy. And I think, Paul, you're right. That's where I think there's a difference between Last Jedi and this. It was the fact that these characters had a purpose. And I'm with you. I'd watch a movie with them in an instant. I think that they're entertaining characters. They have a function to them. I enjoy the humor with them because of the fact that when they appear on the scene, they've upgraded his ship for him. which I think is way cool.
Yeah.
And the interactions between them and Grogu is terrific as well. So all of that stuff just worked in really good ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as is my wont, for the most part, I try to avoid spoilers before I see the movies. And this one, there really was not a lot that I was presented with. I had seen a couple of commercials on TV, but that's really it. And I got definitely was you know, I saw the commercial. I pointed it to my wife. I said, I'd like to go see this. And she was like, that's fine. We'll go. And in that respect, she is an enabler. But anyway, I didn't, you know, I avoided spoilers, and that's good for me. So I'm sitting there and the movie's starting to roll and the credits are coming across the scene, and I see Martin Scorsese, and I think, huh? And I saw Sigourney Weaver, and I thought, huh? Now, Sigourney Weaver kind of played the role, like, you know, it was not surprising that they had her in the role that they did. And I'm saying, when am I going to see Martin Scorsese in this thing? But when his CGI character came on, I found him quite amusing. And I, you know, to Sean's point earlier, though, I kept saying to myself, well, that's Martin Scorsese's voice. And, you know, I was very, very conscious of it. But I still found the character to be amusing, and I enjoyed the moment. I thought his inclusion was a good thing. So I'm curious, you know, what you thought about those little moments.
I'll start with Scorsese. I'm with you. I caught the voice. I don't have a problem with that. Like, that was, and actually, it's funny, I'm more critical of when Pedro's helmet comes off. And it sounds like I don't like him. I really do like him. I agree with you. Paul, I think you're nailing the overexposure part. I think in these type of movies is really what's hurting him. It's not him. I've enjoyed him in quite a few things. But I think the difference between Scorsese and that was a cool cameo. And that worked for me. And Sigourney Weaver's character, I thought the New Republic stuff was pretty cool. I enjoyed that quite a bit. Yes, I knew it was Sigourney Weaver, and I didn't get taken away from, you know, the idea that it was Sigourney Weaver. But I liked the New Republic's interactions with Mando. I liked the idea that she's even, you know, listen, I know you keep saying you're a free agent and all that, but, you know, at some point in time, you're going to admit you're one of us. And yeah. And I liked that whole bit with all of them. How, you know, he, because of the fact that he's evolved during the show, he did not complete the mission the way that they intended for him to complete the mission. And I thought all of that was good. I thought her reaction to that was good. I liked the debate between them. I thought there were some great dialogue moments in all of that that all worked for me. So I thought she played a really good role in all of this. Dave Filoni, if I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, he made a cameo too in this. And I thought that worked as, you know, from a Hitchcock perspective, I thought that kind of worked as well. You were supposed to know it was him. And I'm not against those when they happen. It's the ones that take me out of the film. None of those did. None of those took me out of the film. And so I was good with all of them. It was nice to see them in the film. I think they worked in well, and I enjoyed it. But I'm with you on Scorsese's voice. It was like, I picked it out right away. Admittedly, because it was in the credits. I don't know if they weren't in the credits, if I would have gone there, if I would have thought, like, because of the CGI, I don't know that I would have been, maybe I would have said it sounds like Martin Scorsese. I don't know that I would have gone there. I really feel the credits kind of cued me to, like, look for him more than anything else. But I thought all of the cameos and people added in there were fun, good fun.
And remember, on Dave Filoni's character, though, he is an established character. I mean, he's been in the series a number of times, so it made sense to have him. That's one reason it doesn't take you out of it with him in there, is because it makes sense. His character has been in the show several times as Trapper Wolf.
Now, I'm trying to remember what the I'm not good with the names of the characters. The pilot from Rebels, Jeb.
You're talking about Zeb.
Zeb.
What
I heard, if it's accurate, is that he was created from the original character design for Chewbacca.
Yes.
I find that to be fascinating.
Yeah, that's true. You know, there was a lot of Rebels. The Rebels show, there was a lot of, especially in the early days of that, there was a lot of hearkening back to Ralph McQuarrie. A lot of it. In fact, the TIE fighter designs, if you look at them, they don't look like they do in the movies necessarily. They look like early Ralph McQuarrie TIE fighters. There's just a lot of Rebels that follows those designs, and he is definitely one of those. And I love when they do that, because I don't think Ralph McQuarrie had a lot of bad ideas that got committed to canvas. And so, yeah, you know, anything that didn't get used could definitely be used later.
I totally agree. I found that to be just a fascinating little tidbit about that character. Just to get a little bit more to the bones of making the movie, I thought the direction was really kind of like, I'm going to stay out of your way. I didn't think Favreau really had a desire to put a fingerprint on this so much. I thought he did a pretty good job with the action sequences. I don't know if there's any second unit work going on there or if that's all his, but I thought they were well choreographed, well put together, and they were engaging, which was really, to me, the saving grace for this as a theatrical release. You know, again, on TV, it would have been fine, but in the movies, I needed something more in the theater. And I thought the action sequences gave me the spectacle that I wanted to see on the big screen. So that was the plus as far as that goes, as far as I was concerned.
And, you know, he's done enough studio work that he knows how to do a movie for the studios. I mean, you know, he did Jungle Book and he did Lion King, and, you know, and I think Iron Man was more his movie, but he's done enough studio work to kind of know when to just step out and just capture it and when to make his movie.
Yeah, I would agree.
He's one of those guys you really do kind of want. If you're having a creative project and you have the opportunity to have him on board, it seems like he is always an asset, no matter what it is.
Yeah, I think he doesn't half-ass it. I think if he's on board, mm-hmm. he's on board. End of story. And I think that's the key. And I think that's the reason why he isn't doing any more Marvel movies, because they don't want somebody who's going to make his own voice get heard all that much. They want to give you, here's the formula we want you to put together. And don't get me wrong, I enjoy most of the Marvel movies, but they aren't looking too much for somebody to push the envelope. They're looking to kind of stick with the structure they're looking for.
There's a certain fanboyism with him too, though. And I don't know if you remember seeing any of this, but when Mandalorian season one came out, there was a lot of talk about how he and Filoni went to his garage and used a camera to shoot, you know, to create a motion control unit to shoot the miniature for the ship. They didn't do CGI for Razor Crest then. And they used miniatures in this movie. In fact, not only did they use miniatures, they bring Phil Tippett in to do a stop motion sequence.
Yeah.
The two big guards guarding the twins, they're Phil Tippett stop motion. That's beautiful. I love stuff like that showing up in here.
Yeah,
and if there's no Favreau there, I don't think it happens.
Probably correct.
I think from a production standpoint, using some of the old tools and bringing them in, I think, gave atmosphere and mood. It separated it from other movies, mm-hmm. and that part worked. It does feel Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I think that's really critical, because I think there is an audience right now that is looking for more Star Wars, and I felt like that part really worked for me.
Apparently, somebody else agrees with you.
Yeah.
What can I tell you?
Is that yours, Paul, or is that Sean's?
No, that's mine. My stepdaughter's boyfriend slept over down in the basement, and when he comes upstairs, the dog loves him, but she barks like crazy to get his attention. So he just must have woken up and come upstairs. Anyway, if I saw this twice, I probably could have consciously made an effort to take note of the score, but on one viewing, you know, I'm trying to be a critic, but I'm also trying to be engrossed by the movie, and I didn't really have any strong opinions on the score. I was wondering, you know, you've seen it twice. Maybe you've had more of a chance to take it in. And I don't know, Sean, if you've listened to it or what, but both, either or both of you.
Sean's got thoughts. I see him.
Yeah, he's just, you know, I'm going to keep talking because he looks like he's really anxious to say something, and I'm just going to be a pain in the ass.
I'm going to see you soon, so I can hit you on the head with a shoe. It's funny. One of the things that I loved, I do love the music from the TV show itself, and I felt like they used variations on the musical theme from the TV show at the right moments. Especially during some of the flight combat scenes, some of the escape scenes, some of the high action scenes where we're expecting like a badass Mandalorian moment. And I felt like that theme was intermixed with, you know, remixed and utilized in ways that I thought worked really well. I think if you like the Mandalorian music from the TV show, which I enjoy quite a bit, you'll be very happy with it in this film, because I thought it was used well. It didn't overtake a scene, which sometimes is done in films where now all of a sudden the score is so much in your face. It added to the sense of drama. It built, you know, the moment that was going on. I love that theme music, specifically the ones relating to Mando himself. And I thought that music in particular worked really well in this.
Yeah, the only point where I felt like I was conscious of it was when they actually did his theme. But otherwise, yes. I can't say it was really jumping out at me. Any thoughts, Scott?
Yeah, the album came out about a week before the film, and I'm a soundtrack guy. And so I was listening to the soundtrack a good ways before the film came out. So I was kind of used to it. By the time the movie came out, I kind of knew all the little cues. And a lot of people love it. And I don't hate it, but there are some things about it that just kind of annoy me, but it's me. It's not, you know, it's not you, it's me.
I invented that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm just such a traditionalist. I just love an orchestral, just a classical vintage orchestral score. And that's not what Goranson, I think he's capable of it, but that's not what he does generally. He's a guy from the Hans Zimmer school, literally from the Hans Zimmer school. And so a lot of film scoring today is like partial music and partial sound effect almost. In fact, if you listen to the score, the album, the arena scene, there is crowd noise in the music. You know, it's that kind of thing. There are a lot of instances where there are literally sound effects woven into the score, you know, not put in by the sound effects team, but put in by the composer. And that's the kind of thing. I like leitmotif. I like everybody having their themes. I like those themes being interwoven. So, you know, it's well done. And Goranson's, he's an Oscar winner. He's very good at what he does. But like when they go all synth, when they go to the I can't remember what planet now they're having the arena on, the battle on, but that goes all synth. And I think that has to do with kind of that town and, you know, evoking the vibe of where they are. But it just kind of, it kind of rankles me because I went in a Star Wars movie. I want to hear a big orchestral score and we don't necessarily get that.
There's a sense of progression in this. I was just thinking of this right now that I actually did like.
Mm-hmm.
With the Mandalorian himself and Grogu, this idea that Grogu is going to live, the exact line he used was, the kid will live centuries beyond me. I won't always be around to protect him. And then it flashes back later with the old protect the young and the young protect the old, that this is the way. This idea that And he's ready to sacrifice himself when like that little ship is not going to contain them. Yes, it wound up being a little bit of a chuckle moment, but it also added a sense of gravity to the fact that he can't get in with them and he wants them to escape, particularly Grogu. He's letting them do it and he's willing to buy them time. He's turning around with the intention of, I'm hurt, I'm poisoned, I'm not going to make it out of this. And you've got to. He doesn't say that to them, but we know it as the viewer that that's where his head's at. That was that sense of danger I was talking about earlier. But I loved that idea of he's feeling that he's more in the twilight of his lifespan. And he's trying to, for the remaining time that he's got, and I think at a certain point in this film, you've got to believe that the character thinks this might be it. I might be buying it here. And that is where the film worked for me with that particular sequence. I like that idea that we are getting to the tail end of the story. It feels like that's coming. And whether that means him dying at the end or not, I don't know. But I did like that sense of forward movement with these characters feeling like we're hitting that stage. And where does Grogu go after that is going to be an interesting part of the story that I'd like to see. But I liked that. I liked that relationship between them, because when you're looking at a being like Grogu and just recognizing I'm not going to be around for this character's lifespan, that was, I thought, well conveyed in this movie.
Yeah, there was almost a sense, and let me ask you what you think about that. There was almost a sense that Rada will outlive Mando, and perhaps maybe he gets to take over care of this being after Mando's gone.
Which I hadn't even thought of that.
I wouldn't.
That's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
Looks like Hutts live about 1,000 years, so. You know, it could be that at some point Mando hands it over to him and says, all right, I'm done taking the rest of the way home. I don't know how long it takes them to mature. You know, they live to 900 years. So.
Yeah.
Well, it's what is at the beginning of The Mandalorian, Grogu is 50 years old, I think they said.
Yeah, 50. Yeah. Yep.
So I don't know how much time has passed from that episode to now as far as the aging of that character, but it can't be. Well, he was with Luke for a while, so I don't know how long that was.
Yes.
You know, then
I don't know. I'd guess 4 or 5 years total.
I'm thinking it's wise for them to not give you a true timeline, because, you know, just leave it to you. Leave it for you to speculate.
Yeah,
I think it's easier to.
You know, that was one of the things when you talk about character development and evolution. Is, you know, there was a lot of speculation that Grogu would say his first words in the film, and it didn't happen. Did any of you guys have that sense that that was going to take place?
No, but I'm kind of glad they didn't, because it would have given me the feeling of Maggie Simpson.
I think one of the areas where I don't know that I was hoping for first words, but I think it goes back to something we've been saying all along. I was hoping for something that would feel like serious progression.
Yeah.
And aside from the longevity piece, I don't know that I felt that in this. My only disappointment was the fact that I didn't feel like this progressed the story much.
Nope.
Other than being an enjoyable story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, I feel like if they had done the ending the way I described, where they were, you know, in a dire situation and somehow Grogu stepped up and showed levels of his power that he hadn't shown before to rescue them, I think that would have left me off with a much more satisfactory ending. I also think if what Scott said, where they end off with something where it's almost like a cliffhanger, like, come on back and, you know, when we do the next season of The Mandalorian, you're going to want to see what happens, because, you know, we left you with a little bit, you know, we ended this story, but we left you with some threads that, you know, you're going to want to see how they're resolved. You know, that was done masterfully in The Empire Strikes Back. They completed the story, but they left so much up in the air to make you want to, you know, see that the Return of the Jedi when it came. I'm not saying this should be the Empire Strikes Back, but, you know, they could have taken a lesson from that and maybe given us something to ponder. Because I kind of feel like, yeah, you know, if you're not really into the universe and you see this, even if you like it, I don't know that you feel compelled. Well, you know what? When the new season comes out, I got to see it. I don't know that you're left with that feeling. And I think that should have been one of their goals.
It's done.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's fair.
Before we rate this, any more thoughts? Anything that we left out that you think was significant?
Nope, I did my sheet.
You did a rating sheet those are your notes to discuss?
No. I just had a sheet of notes, and I think I've covered everything I've scribbled on the notes.
All right. Well, glad we hit on everything. So there's no question in my mind this is not a Jaws. There's no question in my mind this is not a Jaws 4. This was an entertaining movie. So what it comes down to is it a movie that I feel was entertaining to the extent that, oh, I'm really looking forward to seeing it again, or I'm going to be able to do multiple viewings, or we're going to talk about this and there's going to be things about it that are going to stand up in my mind? Or is it, yeah, I enjoyed it, and if I never see it again, that's okay. I kind of feel like it's almost in the middle. So I'm torn between a high Jaws 3 or a low Jaws 2. And I'm going to be generous and give it the low Jaws 2, because I think the action sequences buoy it enough that I would look forward to seeing it again. So that's where I ultimately landed. It's borderline, but it's Jaws 2.
So as I was going through my thinking on this one, we were teetering in the exact same places. I'm landing on High Jaws 3, but a highly recommended High Jaws 3, because I do think it has Jaws 2 moments throughout it. And, there's some amazing sequences. It sounds like I don't like the film. I really do. I'm a big Star Wars fan. I'm glad I saw it. My wife went with it to me, and last night we were out with another couple. She was recommending it to them. So, you know, as far as a fun movie to go see, if you're listening to this, you absolutely should go and see it. I think it's a fun movie. I think where I'm landing on it being High Jaws 3 is it was a safe film, an enjoyable movie. I'm glad I saw it. I am going to watch it again. I'm going to own it. I mean, so it's not like I'm sitting here saying I'm not going to watch this again. The Jaws 2 moments in it were strong enough in it that I'm going to go see this movie again with no problem at all. And maybe I don't know how often I'm going to rewatch it, but I was thinking of things like Rogue One and Solo that we mentioned earlier. And I feel that those were far better movies than this one was as a movie. I feel like this one is a compilation of television episodes. I thought it was enjoyable. I'm glad I saw it, and I would recommend it. But I'm going to go with High Jaws 3 because of the fact that I feel like I think we covered all the reasons why it lacked that movie punch that I was looking for. But I do recommend viewing it, and I will definitely see it again.
I've seen it twice, considering a third time, not running away in fear from the third time. I've had several robust discussions with it, including a great one with you guys today. And I'm gonna put it on Jaws 2. But you gotta understand, like I rate all Kiss albums and Star Wars movies differently from other things. And so it's going to have the benefit of the doubt by virtue of being Star Wars from the start. But I would say ultimately I'm gonna land on a Jaws 2.
All right. And since I landed on Jaws 2, I'm thinking that's fair. I want to thank you, Scott, for making time in your very busy schedule to join us today.
And I'm glad to do it.
Very much. And I look forward to the next time we can talk about something, whether it be comic books or movies.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And thanks, Sean, as always, for joining me. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
Who's Lollywood that dog? Mandalorian, steel, priceless on the black market.
But what's even more is knowing we have shamed you forever.
We know the Mandalorian creed. You, the outcast, for letting an enemy see your face.
Not if you all die.
It will bring us ecstasy to watch your strong spirit break.